This podcast is part of the Batman Universe Podcast Network, hosted by the batmanuniverse.net. Check out everything related to Batman and the entire Bat family at the batmanuniverse.net, including news and original content related to comics, movies, television, merchandise, video games, and more. Also, check out some of the other unique podcasts that TBU has to offer. Consider supporting this podcast by becoming a patron on Patreon. Even $1 can go a long way in supporting this content that you enjoy. Look for a link over at thebatmanuniverse.net to offer your support now. And now, on with the show.
I'm back, baby! I'm back!
The boys are back in town!
We turned around, guys. We are back, baby. We are back.
We are back.
Yeah.
Classic.
We are back.
That's
we
right.
are back. We are getting back.
And we're the three best friends that anybody could have. We're the three best friends that anyone could have. We're the three best friends that anyone could have. And we'll never, ever, 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 ever leave each other.
Have all four sidekicks ever been in the same place at the same time?
Don't call us sidekicks. Not after today.
I'm back in business, baby!
Why let them tell us what to do? It's simple. Get on board, or get out of the way.
You just don't get it, do you? You went off mission. That was a huge mistake.
Impulse? That's so crashed!
I'm back, baby!
Why isn't anyone ever just whelmed?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 12 of Everyone Loves Young Justice Podcast. I'm Rob.
And I'm Jay.
And this podcast is brought to you and hosted by the BatmanUniverse.net that is celebrating 80 years of Batman this year. You can find us on all social media outlets. We are on Twitter at ELYJ Podcast. You can find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/ELYJ Pod. And you can email into the show at ELYJ Podcast@yahoo.com. And if you listen on iTunes, send a review and that'll help spread the word of the show. And we will read your reviews on the show. Like I said, I'm Rob and Jay is here with me. And before we get into issue 9 of the 2019 version of Young Justice, I would like to talk for a brief moment about Brian Michael Bendis and maybe looking into the future of DC Comics just for a moment. Again, this could be a whole episode on its own, but there's going to be some big changes coming in the future. It sounds like they haven't officially said it, but I feel like every day another comic book site is reporting on things that could be happening to some primary characters and what that might look like. One of the first big ones that it sounds like, well, not sounds like, is that Superman is going to be losing the Clark Kent identity again. People are acting like this is the first time. This is probably the second or third time that this has happened. And I don't know if I like just like the same verbiage that he used with Tim Drake, you know, like this is going to be forever or this is going to be permanent. That's kind of what Bendis is saying again and hearing that I'm kind of seeing some things on the horizon that I'm not looking forward to. And it's making me think potentially of cutting books and almost reverting back to like, well, I've got holes in my comic book collection that I've been kind of wanting to pick up. So maybe that's how I'm going to pick up comics. So I don't want to judge a book by its cover until I read it. But is there anything that gives you pause or gives you concern? Or are you like, I'll consume whatever it is until I don't like it? Where do you kind of fall in these things that hearing that the Trinity could be replaced with new people and Clark Kent losing his identity and, hey, we're going to age everybody up in this DC universe has been in existence since World War II, that type of stuff. So any little things you want to pull out of that before this becomes its own show?
Yeah, we can try to keep it brief here because Brian and I talked a lot about this on Comics Now a couple of weeks ago. So I don't want to repeat myself if anybody, you know, listens to both shows, but I also, you know, have kind of like with the Drake thing, I've kind of said my piece about it and just kind of want to move forward. Ultimately, I mean, I do like the idea of trying to make a definitive timeline. On the one hand, I think it's cool about making Wonder Woman the character that like kicks off the, you know, the first age of heroes that they have. That's cool, you know, giving kind of Wonder Woman the spotlight, capitalizing on her popularity and her importance as a character. And I mean, even, you know, how she's an ageless Amazon, 80 years removed, having Superman be the start of superheroes back in the 30s and have him still be active in, you know, 2019 doesn't make sense chronologically. So if you want to have it be like a real time thing, then yeah, it makes sense for Wonder Woman to appear first. The thing that, and I wouldn't even say it's disappointing because at this point I'm honestly not surprised about it, but one of the most recent issues of Doomsday Clock was all about the importance of Superman. How anywhere Dr. Manhattan went in the multiverse, the main catalyst that started, you know, any age of heroes, any rise of superheroes, any change in the world for the next stage where, you know, where heroes come to play started with Superman crash landing in that field in Kansas and, you know, being found by the Kents. That's what it all came back to. To borrow Michael Bailey's, you know, show name, it all comes back to Superman. So that was the entire purpose of, I want to say it was issue 9. And it was great. It was a great issue. It really helped you kind of see what Geoff Johns was trying to do with the series and where he might be taking it and where he would want DC's stories to go in the future. Now, with this, it almost looks like everything that Johns, all the groundwork that he'd already laid out is being wiped away almost out of spite. Like yeah. They're not doing it because they doing away with it because they have a better idea, but because they just don't want to use those ideas. So they'll think of the exact opposite and do that.
Yeah.
I can't speak for, you know, the DC hires up to say that that's even what's going on. But as a fan, just seeing a lot of this stuff that they're announcing and all these changes that they're making, that is honestly kind of what it feels like, is that they're making these changes to distance themselves from some story threads that the vast majority of fandom welcomed, wanted for years and years, welcomed when we finally got it back and were very excited to see where they could go in the future. And now they're just wiping it away to come up with something else because that wasn't their idea.
Yeah. I think that's the biggest takeaway. And I know, like, I've had my ebbs and flows with comics, that, you know, the rage quit. Ah, I don't like such and such. And then I would go back and look at some of the stuff that maybe, like, Nightfall was a good example for me in the 90s. Like, Bruce Wayne's not Batman. This is stupid. But once I kind of got back into it, Ryan had pointed this out on the Drake, the Jean-Paul coming in, like, that was all organically written into the story. It was never like, we're not purposely getting rid of Bruce Wayne. We're showing you why Bruce Wayne is and needs to be Batman and why this violent version of Batman, the people say that they wanted, once they got a taste of it, they were like, whoa, 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 this isn't what we wanted. So it underlined that point. The stuff that's coming out now is just exactly what you said. This feels like the new 52 potentially all over again, but even more heightened. Like, New 52 was changed for the betterment of DC Comics, but it's some parts really still felt like it was changed for the sake of change.
Yeah.
And you said it the best. This sounds like it's just changed because, well, screw that guy. You know?
Exactly.
So, you know, it's going to be interesting. I'm really looking forward to tying in to get a hold of Batman with Tony Daniels on Earth. That looks great. Detective Comics has been really good. Mm-hmm. And I feel like all these books that are going to come out probably over this next year, I'm going to want to really hold on to those books and really enjoy, because I'm thinking 12 months from now, the DC universe is going to look really, really different, and I hope this is not the straw that breaks the camel's back, because if it is, there's going to be another crisis, and it's going to be a massive one, and I don't know how many fans you could potentially tick off and how many of those are just going to say, you know what, forget it, I'm done. Like, I've gone down this road too many times. I kind of feel like this is dangerous ground. But again, this is like, to keep quoting Michael Bailey, this is like a 500-foot view, and it's hard to say what the color of that flower is from 500 feet in the ground because we're still so far away from it.
Yeah.
But even going back to Superman's identity coming up, and somebody that I respect very much in Michael Bailey is completely against this notion of the identity be taking away, you're missing those core bits of the character. And again, like I said, this could be a whole podcast on its own. So these books, I don't know, with Young Justice, this is like a window potentially into a different universe that the team is bouncing around on.
Generally, I mean, to kind of keep a little more maybe about what we're talking about with Bendis, I've generally been liking what he's been doing on Superman and Action Comics. I mean, to your point, the thing about the secret identity being lost, given up, it's the same with Luke Fox supposedly becoming Batman soon. It's not so much the story idea that they're going with. It's the fact that it's already been done in the past few years already. You know, because that, like, the whole Truth storyline was only like 3 or 4 years ago when Superman lost his powers and his identity was exposed. And then I think I was talking back and forth, like, I think it was Ryan Haas and maybe Pete Vera, a couple of other guys on Twitter, about how with Luke Fox becoming Batman next year, this will be the fourth person to be Batman in under a decade. Because, you know, the kind of bookending it, you had Bruce, and then when Bruce, you know, quote-unquote died in Final Crisis, Dick became Batman. Bruce came back. Then, you know, Bruce was Batman for, you know, a while in the New 52, but then he gets amnesia, and Jim Gordon becomes Batman. Then Bruce becomes Batman again after that. And that was, again, like that Truth story, that was only, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. And now, after we've only had the, you know, I mean, not even quote unquote, the real Batman and the real Superman back in the comics, they've only been there for a couple of years now, and now they're not going to be the same again. So it's just kind of exhausting. One thing that that Brian and I talked about with, like, Crisis on Infinite Earths, what made that special was it was the first of its kind that had ever happened. Now we get a crisis every, you know, 5 years. So it just doesn't do it. But anyway, coming back to Bendis, I really have generally been liking most of the stuff he's been doing at DC.
Same here.
I mean, Event Leviathan, I think, is kind of a dud. It was an interesting idea, and I love the lead up in Action Comics. Like, I love here. Those. And I love, even though he's not writing them, I love the Lois Lane and especially the Jimmy Olsen books that kind of spun out of it. Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen is maybe my favorite DC book right now. It's just it's so fun. But generally, I've been liking what he's been doing with the character.
To the Batman thing, this is always one of those sentences that, boy, I could really step in it. Like, Luke Fox is not in a book. Any shape, form, whatsoever. It's not like the Batwing title is the top-selling book, and people are like, oh my gosh, Luke Fox is the greatest thing since sliced bread, and it is really starting to eclipse the Batman book, and Tom King's having to tread water and add, you know, Detective Comics 1000, Luke Fox is nowhere to be seen. Mm-hmm. If anything, it's like they're trying to shoehorn Duke Thomas into different places, like characters like Bluebird, right? Blanket on her name.
Harper Row.
Yeah, Harper Row. She's come and gone. Duke's there trying to find a spot for him. The original Batwing, David, he was taken out. Then we bring in Luke Fox. So I have a hard time believing in November of next year, August, whenever this is supposed to happen, that all of a sudden Luke Fox becomes Batman, and it's not Dick again, it's not Jason, it's not Tim. If this were a DC movie, event, or in the 90s, the lineage would go to the next available Robin. That's how this would set up. So the best way that I mean no disrespect when I could say this, I feel like this is a check mark that this is going to be the first type of this Batman. So that is why we're doing it, potentially.
What you're dancing around. Yeah, I mean, I understand. I have nothing.
And
I know you don't either. I mean, it's not the fact that it is a black man who's going to be Batman.
Right.
It's that it's Luke Fox. Like you say, he's not been in the books. I mean, I feel like Duke Thomas's story has been rushed. And again, he's a character that they've tried so many things to make him fit and work, and he still has yet to find anything as good as when he was in the We Are Robin book. I think that was the best that Duke has been as far as a character is when he worked best. Now he's Signal and he's on the Outsiders, and I mean, they're effectively trying to find a place for him. But I mean, with Luke, I don't know that he's even appeared in a comic since Tynan had him in a couple of issues in his run on Detective. I mean,
I've got an action figure on my wall. I think it's a great action figure. I've got him set up with all my Tynan characters, you know, and all that stuff. But, you know, when they brought him in, I thought, oh, that's a really cool character that they got there. But to hear that this is the person, I mean, if they said it was going to be Duke Thomas, I would have went, oh, all right. They've been trying to find a place for him, and maybe all the other Robins are unavailable or whatever, or Tim's still in the multiverse, whatever that is.
Yeah.
Like, I could go, all right, I can see what you're trying to do. I can follow the thread. This, to me, right now, you're going to have to start writing stories to prep to put Luke in.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the thing with Duke is, I mean, your point exactly. He's at least been there. He's been present in the comics. Whether I like his character arcs or not, you know, withstanding, he has at least been a presence in the Bat family pretty consistently for the past several years. So there is at least a way within the story that you can understand why he would get it. Luke's disappeared, you know, effectively for, you know, the past several years. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, he's going to be the next Batman. It just doesn't feel earned for him is what it is. Unless, and I mean, even then it would be a detriment to, and I really don't have much of an attachment to Luke. I didn't read his Batwing book.
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard it was fine, but I mean, I've not read it. The only thing I've really read of him was in Detective on Tynan's run, and he was kind of a butthead in that book.
kind of was, yeah.
And I didn't necessarily like him. The thing about it is he hasn't necessarily earned it. So unless the way he becomes Batman is there is literally nobody else who can take up the mantle because of some sort of tragedy or event that knocks everybody out of commission, and it has to be Luke because he's the one who's there. That's really the only way I could see it making sense right now. But even then, that's kind of, you know, dragging his character through the mud to say, you know, you were the bronze medal. that's what we right. have here. You know, you weren't the first choice. You weren't even the second choice. You were, you know, effectively the last place finisher who got this because nobody else could. So I don't see how it can satisfactorily be Luke Fox.
Yeah.
Like, is it Brian actually came up with a good point that if it wasn't going to be Duke and they did want a black man, why not take Jefferson, Black Lightning? Because, I mean, he is at least part of the Bat family leading the Outsiders. So, you know, why not? And he and Batman have conflicting ideologies. So it'd be interesting to see him, even though they're both heroes and they respect each other, they don't have the same methods at all. Or even, you know, the same motives. So it'd be really interesting if he were to take up the identity of Batman and use his sensibilities that he's learned and that drive him as his own hero and everything. That would have been really interesting. So with everything, I'm willing to give it a chance, willing to give it a shot. I'm willing to be pleasantly surprised and to find that, you know, these could possibly be, you know, some of the best DC comics we've read in years. If they are genuinely that good, just right now, this just seems like a ploy to try to shake things up just for its own sake, to drive up sales, when really all it looks like it's going to do is drive away the people who are already buying your books.
Right. And I've maintained, since the New 52, I've maintained 14 to 15 books monthly. And that's the most books I've ever bought ever. In Rebirth, I was up around 16, 17 books at one point. I'm still, every month I'm kind of like, oh, I need to weed some down, you know, get myself, back to Gotham. But we're going to take a quick little break, play a couple promos, probably from Michael Bailey. We probably should, since we mentioned him a couple times on the show.
Yeah, definitely.
We'll do a couple of his promos. When we come back on the other side, Jay and I are going to take a look at Young Justice issue number 9, and we will get some Teen Lantern talk on this episode, so don't go anywhere.
In 1939, Bob Kane and Bill Finger created a shadowy crime fighter steeped in the pulps and crime dramas of the time. That character was Batman.
Over the next 80 years, Batman not only became one of the most popular comic book characters of all time, but also became a television and movie phenomenon, appearing in both live-action and animated projects.
And then there are the plethora of video games, trading cards, action figures, and statues that have been made of him and his cast of characters.
Because of this, Mike and I want to spend the next year celebrating his 80th birthday.
And we're calling that celebration the Overlooked Dark Knight celebration of Batman's 80th birthday.
Yes. But really? Really? That's the best name that you could come up with. You've written panels, dude, and that's the best thing you could come up with.
It's accurate.
Yeah, but you know, you and I have been podcasting a long time now. That was the placeholder name. We can do better than that.
Okay, what's your idea?
Well, what did we call it in the first episode of this series that we've already recorded?
I really have no idea. It's a miracle that I remember what books we talked about.
Well, that's fair, because I don't remember that either.
Anyway, Andy and I are going to be spending May 2019 to May 2020 talking about Batman stories from all eras that we feel are either overlooked or too awesome not to talk about.
We're even going to have special episodes dedicated to things like the 1989 Batman film and what issues of Detective Comics we would include in a big hardcover collection.
Episodes will drop twice a month.
You sure about that?
To the best of my ability, episodes will drop twice a month at www.fortressofbailitude.com.
You can also find the show on iTunes or through your favorite podcast app.
The Overlooked Dark Knight celebration of Batman's 80th birthday.
Because everyone is doing it, but we're doing it for a whole year.
The Overlooked Dark Knight is part of the Fortress of Baileytude Podcasting Network.
All rights reserved.
Have you ever read a Superman comic?
Not in the last few hours.
Oh, I was just checking, right? Just checking.
Hey, everyone. My name is Michael Bailey, and I have been a fan of Superman for as long as I can remember. In 1987, I started collecting the Superman comics as a going concern, which led me down a long and winding comic book-filled path to 2007, when I first started podcasting. Well, it's 2017, and because it's been 10 years since I started podcasting, and 30 years since I started reading Superman full-time, I thought it might be fun to start a new show called It All Comes Back to Superman. It All Comes Back to Superman will be my monthly reaffirmation of my Kryptonian faith, where I will pick out something about the Man of Steel and discuss it. Sometimes I'll be alone. Sometimes I'll have a guest. No matter how many people get involved, Superman will be the focus. It All Comes Back to Superman as part of the Fortress of Baileytude Podcasting Network. New episodes will drop on the 28th of every month. This show and all of the other programs that are part of the Fortress of Baileytude Podcasting Network can be found at www.fortressofbaileytude.com.
Recognize Superboy B-04.
Well, if you're ready, Jay, why don't we move into issue 9?
Absolutely.
I think by the time we review this, the issue 10 will be at our doorstep in a few weeks.
Yeah, exactly.
So why don't you take us through issue 9 here?
All right. So we've got another nice cover here. I'm getting to the cover art here, which I think the credits are actually toward the end of the book this time.
Yeah.
I want to give credit where it's due. All right, so the cover is from Tim's in an L Tabe. That's what I thought. I just wanted to double check and make sure. This is definitely one of those covers that just kind of, I wouldn't say generic, but just one of those just random issue that you'll find in like a quarter bin, and you'll probably, you know, see some variation of this staging with any number of different comics. You've got the bad guys up at the top, you got the good guys down at the bottom, they're facing off, and then there's, you know, just some generic blurb. Whereas I loved the blurb on issue 8. Everything that's going on here is, I mean, it's not awful. It's staged pretty well. It's just, it doesn't really, it's illustrated too much like a scene that probably should be just a page in a comic to really stand out well as a cover. And it's not abstract enough to stand out well as a cover either. So it's okay. What are your thoughts on it?
Ditto. I feel like this is circa 1970. Not to repeat, but I'm going to repeat. It's the dollar bin comic book. Like that was the thing they used to do in, you know, the 60s and 70s. You'd have the word balloon off to the side, and it's almost cheesy. Like the issue I'm thinking of, I think it's Detective Comics, it's 300 something, where Batman's looking for Robin and some villain has pushed Robin off like a silo and he's getting ready to crash down. And Batman's like, Robin, where are you?
Yeah.
It's like, you're going to find Robin in like 3 seconds. He's going to hit you in the head.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. It's nothing to write home about. But again, like we've said before, I couldn't draw this. But,
oh, no. You know. I mean, the skill is great. I mean, the characters. Yeah,
the composition is lacking.
Yeah, exactly. The characters. And like I say, even if it was a page from the book, this would be a cool splash page. Maybe if this was the kind of the cliffhanger final page of the book, this would probably suffice pretty well. But as a cover, it's just not doing much for me. I do like Hex. Not Ginny Hex, but Hex. I like her hat. Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Isn't Superboy, the evil Superboy, Luther, isn't he wearing the 1998 costume of Connor eventually, like kind of, sort of, where the jacket's gone, he's got more of the red pants and the blue shirt?
Yeah, he is. Good call. I didn't even think about that. I like his little spiky bracelets, too. Those are a nice touch to let you know that he's bad news.
Yeah.
Anyway.
He listens to the moans and Rancid.
Probably more Rancid than anything.
Yeah, right.
All right. So within the book, the recap page, you know, just takes us over what's been going on in the book, which, again, I like that they've been doing this. I liked the previous issue's recap page maybe a little bit better.
Yeah.
Because it was effectively the final page of issue 7, just with the recap pasted on top of it. So you could just see where Young Justice wound up at the end of the previous issue, and then just pick right up where they left off. That was kind of cool. The ending of issue 8 really wouldn't make much sense to do that. So they've got the, you know, little multiverse portals with Ginny Hex's truck just kind of floating around in the nothing down there.
I like that that's a gag.
Yeah, me too.
Through most of these, the truck is constantly, like, they're not in it and it's floating around.
Yeah, the truck is almost the super cycle of this Young Justice series. I just thought of that.
That's amazing.
And I'm okay with that. I like that truck.
Same here.
It looks old and beat up, but it has a lot of character and personality. I like that. So most of this issue, as hinted at with the ending of the previous issue, is the secret origin of Teen Lantern. So when we go from the recap page, we actually go to kind of a junkyard in La Paz, Bolivia, 1 month ago. And we see a young girl who is obviously a Teen Lantern. She's looking for somebody in this junkyard. You see a lot of little familiar objects to us, like a Green Arrow and a Star Labs sign there, and even various other...
The Wayne Enterprises box down the very bottom of the first page.
Yes, there is. There it is. Yeah, I knew I saw something else at some point, but I can't remember what it was. So, yeah, good call picking that out. That may be Jenny Hex's truck before she found it again and, you know, fixed it back up there at the bottom left. But no, I mean, this is we find out her name is actually Kelly, and her brother Marcos. They're just, you know, looking around in the garbage here until they hear a motorcycle come up and then see some sort of alien figure who is being held at gunpoint by the ne'er-do-well who is riding that motorcycle. And then they witness an attempted murder on this alien and then run off back to their homes. And it just kind of eats away at Kelly, and ultimately she decides that she needs to return to see if she can help, or at least, you know, find something to help that alien there. So what do you think of these first, you know, half dozen or so pages here to kind of set up this story?
This is one character that they've been teasing at and hinting. I think for a lot of us, we can figure out who Jenny is, and we knew most of the core characters, basically of everybody else but Teen Lantern. And my money is on that this is actually based off of Brian Michael Bendis' daughter. I don't think that's good, bad, or indifferent. I almost feel like this is a representation of her to some degree. Oh, so I would sure, not be sure. Surprised if he's not basing the character off of her. So this is, I mean, she's not living in Metropolis. She's not around a whole bunch of other heroes. Later on, you find out they know who some of these people are. But it was a different change of pace from the issues we've had so far. That this, if I didn't know, if you just showed me these pages right off the hand, I couldn't have told you this was Young Justice, or if this was even maybe a DC comic, if you didn't have the Green Arrow in there, a different thing. So this was completely different, and I don't not like it because it's different. It was just a different feel and even a different art style than what we've had previous up to this point. And it looks, the whole world is completely different than anything that we've seen, even just in Rebirth in general. It's almost more of akin to maybe what Naomi is kind of like.
Yeah, it definitely looks more like the real world than a lot of these other, you know, vistas in cities that we would see in other DC comics. I do like the fact that the flashback scenes are illustrated by a different artist. I'm not sure what where they're from, but they are a Spanish or Hispanic artist, Andre Lima Araujo. I doubt that's how you say their last name, but I'm going to...
God bless you, because when I give the synopsis and stuff like that, I'm going to take your audio. That was amazing.
Okay. But I really, really, really liked like their visual aesthetic. It reminds me of a more refined and cleaner Riley Rossmo.
Oh, yeah.
I can see some of the influence, especially in not so much, like, I think the anatomy of Araujo here is definitely more like standard proportions, whereas Rossmo's is very much exaggerated. But in some of like the eyes and the mouth, and even how there's just something there that is kind of akin to Rossmo's style as well. Especially, like, if you look on the page where that alien, quote-unquote, Green Lantern is shot, and Kelly and Marcos, almost called him Ramon. I'm not sure why. I think because you said the Ramones earlier. That was in my head. Yeah. But Kelly and Marcos are standing there, and then, you know, he fires a shot, and then there's that panel where it's just a red background, and Marcos is covering Kelly's mouth so she doesn't make a sound. Mm-hmm. Definitely a little more exaggerated. That's where I can see some of that Rossmo influence there. But I mean, other than, you know, some faint hints here and there, I definitely think this is a unique style that's not really derivative of anything. And I really like it. I like how he makes the the junkyard, you know, feel kind of dirty and gross, as it should. Mm-hmm. But then you still have those bright colors of like the purple of her shirt and the red of her backpack, and then the blue of Marcos's shirt, and even that purple motorcycle just kind of popping out against the drab and dreary backgrounds. Honestly, I mean, I would read a lot more of this, because I think that his visual storytelling here is just fantastic. And I like that Bendis had the confidence in, I'm going to assume that the artist here, I like that he had enough, you know, confidence in his style and storytelling abilities to have a lot of these silent passages where it was the visuals that are telling us everything we need to know. Even when it goes back to Tim's later in the book, whose style I like as well, it doesn't really clash because they're supposed to be two distinct time frames. So I think that was a really creative way to use the two separate artists.
Oh, yeah. And one of my favorite panels, and again, darn it, DC, number your panels. It's right after the Batman Snickers ad where she is sitting in her bed in the dark, and there's that one sliver of light coming through like an open door or open curtain where she's starting to remember. And I'm glad you mentioned the eyes. The way that he draws the eyes through here, especially her eyes, is telling you everything you need. This is a book I would read about this character. And I don't read much other stuff in comics. If it doesn't have a cape on it, and generally if it's not in Gotham City or something like that, I don't normally get out of my comfort zone. This makes me want to read more from this artist and in this style. I would read a book on this. I'm just going to go ahead and say it. This was my absolute favorite section of the two books that we've read. I was really intrigued. Just the art just pulled me in. And like you said, it's one of those things where you could have silent panels in a book and you're just kind of flipping like, oh, okay, I spent time looking at these pages.
Yeah, especially when, like you said, I love that detail of that just thin sliver of light coming through her door while she's sitting, you know, guilt-ridden and distracted on her bed. And then, you know, you see her eyes and some beads of sweat rolling down the bridge of her nose. And then there's just the black and white and with the gray tones where you just see the gun firing a shot. And then, you know, she just looks down to the side, you know, trying to remember more details of it. And then, you know, honestly, trying to talk herself into doing what she feels like she needs to do. It's some great, I never know if acting is the right word to use for illustrations, but I mean, there's definitely those facial expressions tell you everything that she's thinking. So we don't need any dialogue. We don't need any internal narration or monologuing. It's all there in the visuals. And I mean, frankly, I mean, not to, you know, spoil my thoughts too early, I think this, just because it's so different visually and structurally and in how her story is being told, especially, this may be one of the strongest issues of Young Justice so far, just for these flashbacks alone.
Oh, yeah, I will co-sign that all day long.
Yeah, so after that, Kelly decides she knows what she needs to do. She throws her shoes and her jacket back on and makes her way back to the junkyard. And, I mean, again, from the time she returns home and does some quick Google searching to see if she can find out if there were any reports of an alien invasion or some weird weapons there, or if there's a Bolivian Green Lantern she'd never heard of. After that, for two pages, there is no dialogue whatsoever. The only word is that blam in the background of the panel where the gun is being shot in her flashback or her, you know, her memory rather. And then, you know, she just silently walks back to the junkyard and encounters this fallen, maybe, maybe not Green Lantern. And then they have a discussion where, you know, you find out that he at least has encountered the Green Lantern Corps and is wearing a Green Lantern costume, but is wielding effectively a bootleg, unauthorized weapon that he shouldn't have. But he tells Kelly to take care of it. And I mean, he's effectively telling her to take advantage of it and, you know, use it to get what she wants in this world. He says, you make as much as you can with it. You own this world with it, and then throw it in the fire before, you know, she thinks that's it's an honor. She's being inducted into the Green Lantern Corps. Right. But he's effectively telling her that, you know what, without outright saying it, he's effectively saying that the ideals of the Green Lantern Corps and peacekeeping and protecting others, it's not worth it. You know, do what you want with this, and then whenever you're done with it, destroy it so nobody can take what you wanted away from you. Effectively, you know, be selfish and be, mm-hmm. you know, be a villain here. And then Irel, I guess, is how you pronounce his name. Is this alien?
I think, yeah.
Yeah, he, and then he, you know, he just dies. And then it flashes back to the present. Back on Earth 3, where Teen Lantern is fighting her doppelganger, whose name I can't remember. Pretty sure it was in the last issue, but we'll just call her,
I think it's Hack.
Is it Hack?
No, that's what I see. This was the part that was confusing me. Is it Hack, or is her evil version calling her Hack? Because it's not made very clear.
Yeah.
Yeah, it says Hack. My name is Hack.
Okay.
So, yeah, it is Hack. Yep.
Yeah. But, I mean, again, yeah, that wasn't super clear. It's still a pretty fun sequence. I like some of the constructs that they come up with. Like, Teen Lantern comes up with, like, a corkscrew, and then Hack has that big, you know, snake head that eats it. It's a fun sequence, but still, after going through a largely silent earlier section of the book, having it go back into being in the fray with, you know, so much energy and almost sensory overload with some of this stuff. It wasn't necessarily jarring, but it made me appreciate the great quieter storytelling all the more.
Yeah.
What did you think of all like that conversation that she has with this alien before obtaining this strange device and then winding back up on Earth 3 to show the skill that she's developed with this not quite Green Lantern ring that she has?
I thought it's really showing the depth of her character and the compassion that she has. She saw this bad thing, and is, I don't know what she thought she was going to find going back in the evening to the dump, which could have been an even scarier place. But like you said, it's almost like getting the badge of honor, and she's really not hearing it. She knows, like, oh, this is Green Lantern, like, I'm going to get to be a hero, and she is doing something heroic. So I love that whole entire section. But then it's almost like in a movie, you get that snap really quick and you're right back, thrust back in the action. And comics don't make a sound unless you're like doing that with it.
Right.
But I got this. This is going to sound dumb to say. I got this sense of noise and volume getting back to the Earth 3 action, where the book was started out very, like we were talking, is very much silent, and it was telling the story without the use of words, and then it was almost like overload getting into this battle. And as quick as the battle goes, we go right back in to a previous time where we get a little bit more dialogue. So it wasn't jarring in a bad way. I almost felt like there was some movement and sound. Again, that's kind of weird to say in a comic book. I thought it was done very well.
No, I totally get it. I feel like in the flashbacks, like if this was a movie, the flashbacks probably wouldn't even have a score to accompany it. It would just be the
right
natural sounds of, you know, the city, and then the garbage dump that they're in, and then just the limited dialogue between the characters. But then most of the noise would come from, you know, Kelly trying to sneak her way through the dump, but because there is no other sound, even her deliberate footsteps would be all the louder because that's the only thing that you're hearing. So I can definitely see that. And then after she gets, you know, this glove and power pack and looks at it, you could almost hear like the kind of a drone kind of rising up to go into the full-blown score that's going to be playing mm-hmm. during this big battle scene that's coming up next.
And, I agree.
And then one thing that I've seen people point out is that it does seem to contradict something that she said before about how she hacked a Green Lantern ring and that's how she got her powers.
Yeah.
Honestly, I don't see it that way. I don't see it as a contradiction. I mean, yes, she did say that, and this clearly shows that she didn't do that. I mean, until, you know, the character says otherwise to actually contradict this, I would see it as because this is something that she wants and needs to keep secret, but also, I mean, she's young and she does want to be, you know, impress her older teammates and make it sound like she's, you know, maybe a little more capable than she actually is. I wouldn't put it past, you know, an 11 or 12 year old girl to say, oh yeah, I totally hacked a Green Lantern ring. That's how I got my powers. Yeah. So even though, yes, it is a contradiction in the story, I think it's supposed to be that way. It's not a plot hole in the story because a character said one thing when we find out something else.
Right. And have you met an 11-year-old?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure how old your son is, but I'm sure he has said something that has contradicted himself, but that's just the, you know, that's just the world that they live in. They're just playing there, or they're trying to save face for something that they did that they maybe shouldn't do. So if I said, well, I just found this thing from this dying Green Lantern, I'll just say I hacked. You know, so like you said, until we hear otherwise, this is somebody that's trying to keep something secret while still trying to do something good. So I totally bought it in the context of the character, and it was nothing where I was like, oh, this book was so good until I got to this point. So no, I'm fully on board with it.
Yeah, totally. And then when it flashes back to where Kelly shows Marcos, you know, what she found, you know, even he goes on about, you know, oh my gosh, is this a hack? Did they steal Green Lantern's power? So, I mean, even then, that dialogue is still there to say that, you know, maybe somebody did hack a Green Lantern's power source. and Kelly is taking that idea from what her brother said. And the fact that, you know, he also warns her, like, you know, this could be stolen. Somebody could be looking for this. We could get in a lot of trouble for this. So, I mean, she's coming up with her own story about it. So people don't ask too many questions. And she can just say, oh, yeah, I found this. So nobody goes poking around trying to, you know, find the dead alien body that's in the junkyard. And then, you know, find out that there was a murder there. And then they were witnesses. And, you know, that might, you know, cause their family to get in more trouble if the local gang lord or whoever it is that came out there and sent someone to shoot this alien finds out that these kids witnessed this, so they need to go take care of their family and all this stuff. She's probably doing this just to protect herself and her loved ones.
Yes.
All right. Glad we're in agreement there.
That is exactly. That is the most.
I didn't mean that snide. Like, I mean, I was like, all right, you know, we're on the same page. Fantastic.
Yeah.
I am glad we are in agreement there. I also really like that one shot when she finally fully activates the power and then just starts hovering in the air and just takes off.
That was cool.
Yeah, that's just really great. And then the issue ends, you know, going back to Earth 3. And I get a little bit more from Hex, who's just causing all sorts of trouble. That does kind of suck that she takes a shot at Jenny Hex, and it's deflected off of Teen Lantern's force field, and then hits Drake in the shoulder. Poor guy. Oh, no. But then keep going forward, get a little bit more hints that Jenny has something going on with what she has in her trunk. And then finally, we see, if not the map of the multiverse, at least a map of the multiverse that Tim and Stephanie and Bart are looking at here.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this issue. And I enjoyed the issue for the Teen Lantern part. And if you would have asked me back when we first started the show which character I was really excited to see their backstory, I would have been all about Tim, Connor, and Bart. Tim, Connor, and Bart. You know, the boys are back in town. That's the opening theme music to the show. But I was really surprised that Bendis had me wondering about Teen Lantern enough that I was going to walk away from this issue really impressed what he's done with her so far. And to kind of know, okay, now we're going to talk about Jenny Hex in the next issue, which will probably drag out this multiverse fight just a little bit longer till we eventually get them back on the primary Earth. So
yeah, to your point, I mean, what really sells this issue, and I mean, it is the bulk of the issue, is Teen Lantern's story, which was much more engrossing and much more interesting than I thought it would be. I mean, I was curious, you know, about how she obtained this power and where she came from and everything, but I mean, I wouldn't say she's been a dislikable character. You know, we just haven't gotten enough her to be able to, you know, make any judgment of, you know, who she is, other than a, you know, an excited, outgoing, and kind of spunky preteen who has this really powerful weapon. We didn't get anything beyond that. But Bendis and Araujo really, really made her a sympathetic character. Like you said, I cannot say enough how gorgeous that art was, and how great the visual storytelling was, and how it even elevated the scenes that were set in the present just because they were so great. There was such great storytelling there that I was almost on a high, and when we came back to the present time, it, you know, helped contextualize things with her character, made those exciting action scenes all the more exciting because you kind of know where this character's coming from, and it makes it even cooler that she has this strange weapon that we still don't know anything about. It explains enough about her that she becomes more developed as a character, but it keeps enough about the power pack that she has a mystery that we still want to know more about her in the future.
And this makes me, closing this book and looking at the cover, I really wish she would have been more focused. I know, like, thematically from where issue 8 left off, it picks up the theme from, you know, its final pages now to the cover of this page. But this is a Teen Lantern story the whole way through, with the exception of the last couple pages being Bart, Tim, and Stephanie. I would have almost rather had it's almost like that variant cover for issue 1, the Tim Drake cover with, you know, Teen Lantern in the background on it. That would have been a good cover for this, with her being front and center on that issue. So I really kind of wish there was a little better cover to go along with who the issue was actually about.
Yeah, absolutely.
But other than that, like, when they say don't judge a book by its cover, this is literally that. The interior of the book is better than what the cover is trying to sell.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, can't knock the creators for that too much, because most of the time, which I know you weren't, but a lot of the time, creative team has no say over what a cover's supposed to be. They can pitch a cover and say, this is what we want it to be, and then editorial says, you know, do this. Or, you know, they may just have the story in this issue, I mean, may very well have been meant for another issue, and they already had that cover planned out, but they didn't have enough time to change it.
Right.
But even then, I mean, they're still on Earth 3. So, I mean, it's at least, it at least fits in that regard. I've seen, you know, we've both seen much more egregious examples of covers that have nothing to do with the story on the inside. So.
Right, exactly.
So, yeah, I mean, I think you generally gave them, but, you know, overall thoughts on this issue, where would, I mean, not in a ranking scenario necessarily, but where would you put this with the series so far?
I think this is probably going to rise right to the top of the series. If it's not book one, it's book two. It's book one. It's right up there. As much as we were, you know, liking to see the boys back together in those first couple issues and how new and everything was, now that we've kind of landed a little bit, I wish it wouldn't have taken 9 issues to get something like this, where you go, oh man, you got to read issue 9. I wish this was something like, oh man, issue 3 is so amazing. And I mean, they've all been really good, but that this is the cream rises to the top, and this is right at the top of the book so far. It's probably it's in the top 2 or 3.
Yeah. Easy. I think, just as an example of what the excitement of having Young Justice back and the promise of what the book could have been, I still think the first issue may just have been the best as an example of a Young Justice comic.
Yeah.
This issue is probably the best storytelling of the series so far. And yeah. It's an example of what the like second through fourth issues were trying to do that I don't think they quite succeeded at. Because, you know, I felt like a lot of those with especially the issue where it focused a lot on Cassie and what had been going on with her, that felt like a bunch of, you know, shorter scenes that should have been spread out across, you know, five or six issues, just kind of compiled mm-hmm. together, and they didn't really flow together. It just didn't really, it got the information across fine, but it really wasn't the best storytelling. This felt like an almost complete story by itself that you could read separate from the other Young Justice books, but it still enhances the other issues because you get to know more about one of these characters, especially one that we know nothing about because she's a brand new creation for this series. So I like that it stood alone well enough and that it could be read with the series as a whole and still fit.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Jay, we have made it to 12 episodes.
Fantastic.
So as a little peek behind the curtain, as we're watching the counter go on here, that this recording session has lasted 1 hour and 52 minutes, which is code for, hey, we've got two episodes here. So episode 13 coming up, which means I'll have to record an intro for this particular episode. But we're going to switch gears a little bit coming up in issues for episode 13 and maybe episode 14 as we start getting towards the latter end of the year. Something we've been talking about, that this is Everyone Loves Young Justice, but we've had our feet planted in two versions of Young Justice, the 1998 version of Young Justice and the 2019 version. But there are a few other different versions of Young Justice. So we're going to go to the animated universe of Young Justice. So we've got some animated comic books to tie in. We do have a Titans Young Justice comic that we're going to look at. But also, we're going to give you your first commentary track for the Young Justice cartoon series. So if you bought the DVDs like I do, or if you have the DC Universe app, you might want to brush up on the very first episode, the pilot episode of Young Justice. And that is probably, if it's not the next episode, it'll be the episode after that, probably 14, that we're going to give you a couple commentary tracks, or at least we're going to do the first episode, and we'll see how that goes. So you have that to look forward to, and we're really going to encompass the everyone part of Everyone Loves Young Justice. So this is where we're going to end episode 12 here. If you listen to these once a month, you've had a whole entire year of the show, mm-hmm. but we will be back hopefully very soon. But on the behalf of Jay, this is Rob, and you've been listening to the BatmanUniverse.net. But more importantly, you're listening to Everyone Loves Young Justice. We'll see you guys in a couple weeks. Take care. Thanks for listening to Everyone Loves Young Justice podcast. We are part of the BatmanUniverse.net podcasting network.
If you would like to get a hold of us, you can do so a few different ways. We are on Twitter at ELYJPodcast.
We are also on Facebook at www.facebook.com/ELYJPod.
You can email into the show at ELYJPodcast@yahoo.com, and we will read your comments on the air.
If you listen to the show on iTunes, leave a review there. That will help spread the word of the show, and we will read your review as well.
Now, if your mode has been crashed,
or if you feel a bit whelmed by the show, no infringement was intended.
All music and sound clips belong to their respective copyright holders.
These are just to illustrate and enhance your listening experience.
No coinage is, was, or will be made by this show.
Our wives said so. All characters discussed on the show belong to DC Comics.
The opinions on this show belong to the two chatterboxes alone.
Not that anyone else does, but if you want your voice heard, let us know
why everyone loves Young Justice.